Howdy y'all, Editor JT here. Before we start today's episode, I just wanted to stop by and inform you that my co-hosts have been hard at work in my basement, sweatshopping away at bringing you some of the best merch we've ever made. Satisfy your consumer habits, give yourself over to your most primal capitalist desires, and buy through the link below. We've got mugs, shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, all you need to get through the impending nuclear winter with maximum drip. We've got Pocket Sankara, Kissinger and his Hell Buddies, Unhinged Deprogram album art, and much more. This limited edition drop ends exactly 30 days after this announcement. So consume fast and consume hard as you support the show in return for some communist drip. As always, patrons have a 10% discount. Check out the store at deprogramshop.com. And now, back to the show.
So guys, what are your favorite, or I guess I should say least favorite stereotypes about your countries? Mine are obviously alcoholism, violence, and fatty foods, which, let's be honest, are pretty fucking true. What are you guys, so especially with the States and France? I think we have a lot to play with. I'm sure our guest loves hearing wee baguette and so on.
Yeah, the baguette thing. But to be honest, like, it's kind of true. The baguette and the croissant in the morning, it's kind of like, not every day, I would say, but like, it's definitely... For me, it's definitely like a Sunday treat where I go down to my favorite bakery, I get my little croissant, my little baguette. The line is like absolutely insane, especially in my arrondissement, because there are a lot of expats in my arrondissement. So it's like they really feel like they're doing the full-on like French experience by going to that bakery and somehow like it's always the bakery that I want to go to. But so yeah, this, I guess, is kind of true. What else? What else about French people?
Do you all smoke?
That we... Oh, yeah. Smoke. You know what? I'm really working on this. Let's say like 2-ish months ago, I was smoking quite a bit. And now I'm, you know, going back to doing it like only in social context and almost cutting down to zero. But it's like, it's...
Nice.
If you start dating someone who smokes, it's just like, it's just going to happen. Yeah. Like, you can't really fight it, to be honest. And because, I don't know. But a lot of French people will say they're not smokers, but you'll see them going out and like smoking like 20 cigarettes in just one night. And they go, no, it's just like social smoking. It's just it's like, same. Oh, come on. But we'll do
in
it.
Denial.
We'll do
it.
Absolutely the same. And I stopped 6 months ago, very proud, even though I'm cheating very much with like cigars and like little vapes, but non-nicotine ones usually.
Baby steps,
I guess. But you're completely correct. I had to stop together with my partner. Otherwise, it would have been totally impossible. She stopped plenty of times and then, I'm going and, you know, enjoying life and puffing it, and she sees it like, no fucking way, I need one. Especially if you if you indulge in ethanol from time to time and your shield against the cigs doesn't drop, but in my case it completely disappears, so I gotta go grab something. But yeah, cigs bad, no smoke, but it's fun.
I'm over here racking my brains for stereotypes about the United States that are not true. Like, I was like, okay, the obesity rate can't be as bad as everyone says. So I just looked it up. 42% of U.S. adults.
Yeah.
So that's pretty bad. I'm looking at the map. It's all red, except for California and Colorado. Colorado. I was right. There we go. Colorado's not as bad, I guess, for all the skiing. Burgers. Yes, we all love burgers. I went to Whataburger just the other day. As a matter of fact, I hadn't been there in quite a while. Immediately regretted it. Those burgers, they're good, but they're very greasy. Let's see. What else do we have?
Do you all drive trucks? That one is kind of not true because there's lots of like big cities and so on. But suburban areas.
It depends on where you are. Absolutely depends on where you are. I would say in Texas, probably at least 4 out of 10 vehicles are trucks, probably more than that, including in the cities. Most people don't use them for anything. Like, most people don't ever put anything in the bed of the truck because they're not doing manual labor or anything like that. Maybe they'll put their dog in the back of the truck sometimes.
So much space.
Yeah. So what's the, like, consumer culture or whatever aspect of it? Like, it's more like being a cowboy, or, like, what's the pitch that OG advertisers pushed for the truck? Like, extra manly or... Because I know SUVs here are becoming a thing, and it's literally because everybody wants to look like they're in the mob, like... Literally, that's why you drive why the trucks? Why the trucks?
You've got different truck subcultures. You've got your off-road people that are always muddy and stuff like that, and that's fine. That's a legitimate use for a truck, I would say. You put extra tires in the back in case you pop one, stuff like that. Fine, but then you have the cowboys who have never worked with an animal a day in their life. They're always super clean trucks. They're always really expensive ones, like the F-150 Raptor is very popular around Dallas. That's like, it starts at like maybe $75,000, something for that, something like that.
For a truck, that's insane.
And then
you can get like a luxury, proper luxury vehicle in there, like massaging seats, fucking spaceship type of stuff. I don't get it.
I mean, they're nice. They're nice trucks. But then you've got the lifted truck crowd, which those are usually the people who either work on them themselves, which, you know, props, good for them. If they've got a hobby and they want to lift their truck way up high, fine. But then you've got people who are just super aggressive about it. And they're like, I've been in a grocery store parking lot where I could not see over the hood of the truck. It was that tall. And it was just like, you know, a normal Ford F-150 or something that they're big, but they're not that big. It's absurd. There was a study recently, like the school had parents with pickup trucks come and park, and then they would line up the children in front of the pickup truck to see how many children it took before the person driving the car could see one of them.
Oh,
and it's
God.
A ridiculous number. It's like 17 kids or something before you could see the top of one of their heads. It's like, man, no wonder we have so many vehicle like roadkill accidents here. It's not great. Mm. But yeah, so the truck thing is very much a, especially in places like Texas, it's a big part of the culture and for various subgroups. It's interesting.
In France, we actually like do shows, like truck shows, very like American aesthetic, you know, like with the big font and blah, blah, blah. Where it's like, yeah, we're going to show off all the trucks for like the entire weekend, come and hang out and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, we don't want that in France. Please keep those trucks away. But even like in city centers, you see SUVs more and more. And again, it's like, oh, no. But recently, Paris voted to, I think, now SUVs have to pay much more for get a ticket, like for park to when they park. It's like two or three times the amount that it would be for a normal car.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's good. Let's keep those SUVs away and try to, because it's like it's kind of fake. Like the whole, they say it's safer, but I don't think I remember like reading somewhere that it's actually not safer. So it's just like, hey, I have this big old car that I want to show to everyone. It's like, oh no.
Yeah, it's kind of become an arms race here too. Like that's one thing people say. It's like, well, if I get in a wreck, I want to make sure that I win. And so people get bigger and bigger cars. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, it's like everything, you know, it expands and expands and expands, and the, you know, OG pitch for, you know, when they started not selling you pretty much any item, but let's concentrate on cars since we're talking about it. You know, they very much so linked it to masculinity and your status in society, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, everything turns sillier and sillier and more unhinged as we go down this path.
Yeah,
exactly. And now it's the bigger the car, the bigger the man, or the more you lift it. You know, like anybody, for example, that drives an SUV, et cetera, et cetera. Just be honest to yourself while you're engaging in like rabid consumerism, because you get to feel like you're on top of the world and you're flexing on everybody. If you're honest, okay, God bless. But lying to yourself, as you said, Alice, like, oh my God, like it's safer. Oh, it's safer for my kids, et cetera, et cetera. You're just lying to yourself. You just want to be above others because you've like ingested so much ideology that it's directly linked to what you get to tell yourself about yourself as a person, depending on your consumer habit. And that applies to cars and to pretty much anything one can imagine, which are going to be a part of plenty of the topics I think we're going to be talking about today.
Howdy, y'all. Today we have with us the one and only and highly requested Alice Capel. If you're not already aware, Alice makes video essays on politics, culture, and media. She's a master of deconstructing identity politics, and something that most of our guests can't say, she's a published author. Her book, Collapse Feminism, is available on Repeater Books. Alice, thank you for coming on the show, and please tell our audience a little bit more about you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I always struggle to, like, explain what I do or who I am. It's like content creator, YouTuber, influencer, writer. It's like just a bunch of different things. I like the content creator label. I make little videos on the internet, 15 to 20 minutes usually, trying to, as you said, like look at social trends, internet culture, things like that. And you know, bring a little bit of sociology or philosophy into it, bring kind of all the things that I've learned during my studies, and try to make it as entertaining as possible, I guess.
Well, I saw before we started recording that you just put out a new video yesterday,
yes.
My time.
Yeah, yeah.
Birth Control and the Anti-Feminist Backlash. Do you want to pitch that real quick and then we'll get into our questions?
Yeah. So it's like, it must be the same thing for you guys, but I have a list of like thousands of video ideas. Maybe not thousands,
yep.
But like,
yep.
And sometimes
no.
I'm like, oh, maybe,
fuck both
maybe
of
it's
you.
The time
I'm the opposite.
That.
Oh, lucky.
Really?
You
really?
Send me some, God damn it. Yes. It's my biggest struggle,
go
God.
With the flow. But yes, I had this idea of like talking about fertility or something related to that. And then I was like, actually, it might be the right moment because with what's going on in the US, the Washington Post started posting some articles on like birth controls and everything. There was some discourse around that. So I was like, okay, let's finally talk about it. Mm. Usually my videos are like 20 minutes max. This one is like 28 because I had so many things to say. But I felt like it was an important conversation to have because I don't know, like it's the same thing as with the vaccines. It's like, because there was this sort of urgency of like, no, we need to make sure people get the vaccines because like we need to save lives. The left kind of struggled to, you know, properly criticize Big Pharma or even be critical of Big Pharma because it was like, no, like we don't want to divert people from taking the vaccines. And I feel like with what's going on in the US, the abortion bans and just like all the reactionary stuff like emerging, there is again this sort of, no, we can't criticize the birth control, we can't criticize the pill because it's like we need to make sure that especially working class women, especially ethnic minorities, we need to make sure that these women have access to the pill because if they don't, then they are prey to conservatism, like conservatives, whatever they want to get rid of, what's next on the agenda. So yeah, I wanted to explore that topic with nuance, not centrist nuance. I have my own brand of nuance. So that's what I did.
Yeah, I definitely need to watch that one. It is interesting that we've seen kind of this, kind of a shakeup of in cultural identity politics of who gets what, like which side of the American political spectrum gets what discourse baby. Like somehow the left ended up with football. I don't know how that happened recently. and especially like you're saying, yeah, with the pharma stuff, it is interesting to see how willing the left is to engage in conversations about pharmaceuticals, because there is a lot of criticism to be levied there. And that's something I think we are failing on a little bit. But I do see the trepidation a lot of people have. Like if you start saying, oh, you know, Big Pharma's out to get you, then that's a quick one hop, skip and jump to, you know, vaccine conspiratorial stuff.
Yeah.
So I understand the trepidation when talking about people who may not be super well versed on the subject.
Yeah, it's frustrating because you know that if you don't talk about it, then the whole discourse of like Big Pharma is lying to you or they're taking advantage of you, blah, 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 is going to be appropriated by the far right. And I'm not the first one saying it. Like I'm literally more or less paraphrasing what Naomi Klein wrote in her book Doppelganger. You know, like she looked at the way like Steve Bannon or Naomi Wolf appropriated that sort of anti-capitalist language regarding Big Pharma and appropriated it to then, you know, promote far-right ideas, conspiracy theories, and blah, blah, blah. Because the left wasn't there, we weren't doing the proper criticism, you see. So yeah, it was kind of frustrating. But, and again, like, I guess, like, a lot of my work is also about, you know, criticizing liberal media, liberal feminism, whether, no matter where it comes from, because I kind of come from that as well. Like, I was in the past way more liberal, let's say, more center-left. And so coming from that, I see the path towards radicalization, but positive radicalization. And I want to sort of guide people using that language, using that aesthetic also, like a sort of more liberal aesthetic, let's say, to then like, you know, get those discussions and get those, criticize it basically.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach, being more welcoming, less scary, you know, catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, that sort of thing. I think is a great approach, and it's something that I've worked on in the past and I've been struggling with recently, as I've just been super frustrated with people in general, especially around like the whole Palestine thing.
Yes.
But anyway, you mentioned liberal feminism, and that's something that I've wanted to talk about with you for a while. In your video, How Liberal Feminism Turns into Fascism, you show a tweet that's pretty indicative of how misunderstood feminism is in the West. And I want to read the tweet to our audience, and then maybe you can tell us a little bit more about liberal feminism and what makes it so dangerous compared to a more proletarian feminism. The tweet is from Politico Europe, and it says, "In 1992, a 15-year-old schoolgirl went to join her local branch of the far-right Youth Front in Rome. The all-male group of radicals met her with bemusement. 30 years later, Giorgia Meloni is on course to become Italy's first female prime minister." I think that sums it up pretty well, the problem of liberal feminism. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's like you could have added like hashtag go girl, hashtag representation matters after yeah. this, honestly, because it's like...
Yeah.
Yes! I remember reading the tweets and being like, yeah, exactly, sparkles everywhere and like... But anyway, I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. What is this?
Yeah.
Seriously. And you know, when I see this, I'm like, obviously people, like when you look at young people and what they think about feminism, it's like, it's pretty sad. They've done some studies in France regarding that, but even in the US, I've seen some studies that are pretty scary. So obviously people don't want to associate themselves with that sort of ideology because like, it's just so hypocrite. Like, what the fuck? Like, it's... Meloni a feminist, or like, I remember like even Hillary Clinton said something like, oh yeah, like we should, I don't know, I don't want to misrepresent like, what she said, but something like, oh yeah, it's a good thing when a woman get access to a position of power. And it's like,
there's
are you sure?
No analysis there. Yeah,
do you really
like,
want Meloni in a position of power? Do you really want Marine Le Pen, like in France, the far right, in a position of power? And you know what? Like recently, I had a debate with my dad because we always do because we are kind of opposite in terms of political opinions. And he was telling me that 40% of people, like a huge chunk of women, would say that Marine Le Pen, so the candidate of the far right in France, is feminist. And I was like, what?
Wow.
What?
Wow.
So you see, like, there's so much work to do to just, like, what is feminism? Is feminism just representation? That's kind of what we've been told, like, for the past decades, like, since the beginning of neoliberalism, basically, like, hey, it's all about you, it's all about being empowered and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, sure, like, it did benefit some women, especially, like, the, you know, the girl bosses who are often white, who are often bourgeois women coming from the right places, coming from the right social background, etc. But like, is it really feminism? Like, is it really the project that we want to push forward? And I feel like, yeah, definitely. I made a video, I think it was last year, about like the death of feminism, and it was very clickbait because you have to. But like, it was mostly about this, about the fact that we have reached this point where people don't want to identify with feminism, or at least don't really understand what it stands for, and reject it as a natural response to misunderstanding, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's become a problem because you do have this intense negative reaction from mostly the right wing and, you know, disgruntled young men and stuff, where they see the failures of liberal feminism and just kind of equate that with the whole feminist movement, and not really ever experiencing what it means to, you know, truly be feminist or seeing a more proletarian feminism in action. Where do you think that comes from? You know, I know it stems from the neoliberal project, but where did feminism go wrong in the West, would you say?
I think like it's a combination of different things. I guess like there have always been alternatives to the sort of girl boss feminism, but those alternatives aren't very popular because what sells really is the empowerment. Like it's all about that. It's like it's so easily, you can advertise it so easily. You can like, and the complicity of corporations into promoting this form of feminism, the girl boss feminism, the same way that we promote a version of intersectionality that is just about including more people in the workplace or blah, blah, blah. But it always comes down to the same thing, you know. It's like we're trying to bring more and more people into that sort of 1%.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the stories, the success stories, which in the grand scheme like are quite rare. And we don't talk about like the what people would call the 99%, you know, like the working class women who... all those things. So I feel like the conversation is slowly changing, and maybe Gen Z, but again, not to generalize and like turn it into like a whole generational thing, but I feel like younger feminists, let's say, have a more sort of intersectional view of feminism, and therefore are more willing to have those conversations about, hey, it's not just about you as a woman and how empowered you can be. It's about like a sort of collective liberation that is intersects with so many different struggles, not just the fact that we're women, but also the fact that we might be working class, but also climate change, but also this and this and that. And that's where the movement becomes interesting, because it's no longer about a sort of label that you put on yourself. I'm a feminist. It's something you do. Mm-hmm. It's a social project. It's an action. You advocate for feminism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it steps out of the framework that the current system, the current status quo, kind of allows it to exist. And I mean, we talk about this on the show, like into oblivion. But without a material analysis, without at least some commentary on the class dichotomy in society, neoliberalism, capitalism has the innate ability, which is both incredible and very scary, to kind of commodify, inject into itself mm-hmm. any other type of social commentary. And it's very important to understand that once it commodifies it, and once it, to repeat myself, injects it, it creates a sort of perverted version of it. So, you know, very real, very adequate commentary against the patriarchy, how it is directly linked to the way we materially organize society, et cetera, et cetera. It takes this absolute brilliant analysis and absolutely, like, cannot be more on point, and turns it into something that it can call the same thing and yet does not allow it to react to the things it wants to change adequately. And therefore, it perverts it and turns it into, you know, more women in boardrooms without questioning the boardroom itself. Hell, it kind of elevates the boardroom to an extent, because it says, look, now more people have accessibility to the boardroom, you know, minorities, genders, et cetera, et cetera. Look, like, the system is getting better. It's actually incrementally improving, et cetera, et cetera. Well, at the end of the day, it just wants more humans to consume into its belly so that they create more capital gains for it in one way or another. Mm. So, yeah. I could not agree more.
Yeah, I very clearly remember this post I saw on, I think it was the Instagram of Bloomberg Business, something like that. And it was about the CEO of Canva. I can't remember her name, but basically she was like, I mean, you know, they create like subcategories just to, so it was like the first under 35 billionaire yeah. or something like that. It's just like, anyway, but like, you know, they create all those lists and everything, but and I think the message attached to it was bridge the gender pay gap. And it was like, what? It's like bridge the gender pay gap, one female billionaire at a time. And it's like, no. Wow. Once again, I'm like, no, that's not what feminism is supposed to be.
That's amazing. I love that. I love all of the CIA thing too. It's like, you can do it, Mihai. You too can be a war criminal. It's like, man, the disconnect there to be able to write something like that.
Oh, yeah, or the article as well, like the Israeli, soldiers, like the female soldiers.
Oh yeah.
Be like, oh yeah, they're fighting for their country. It's like, yeah, they're killing women and babies, right? Call boss feminism. Yeah, yeah, we love that.
Yeah, that's another part that I think is important to touch on. Can you elaborate a little on the connection of white supremacy to liberal feminism? Like you were saying, the Palestinian thing there, where you have these, you know, quote unquote, brave feminist soldiers of the IDF, but they're butchering, you know, their peers, working class, you know, Palestinian women who are not allowed into this category of woman because they don't conform to this image of, you know, white, secular, upwardly mobile woman with a Western kind of lifestyle.
Oh, gosh, so many things to say about this. And it's quite complex because, like, there are some different mechanisms at play here. I would start by saying that for me, liberal feminism is one big characteristic of liberal feminism is a form of essentialism, as we call it. So it means that, you know, when you hear the phrase, for example, we need more women in powerful positions, I agree with that, you know, like representation still matters. Mm-hmm. But deep down, I feel like there's an assumption that women are inherently good. And so that's what we mean by essentialism. It's like women carry with them those like positive values that they will naturally put to work once they come into powerful positions, which is, actually not the case. Mm. Again, like if you look at Hillary Clinton, if you look at the female Israeli female soldiers, like you see it. It's like, no, like the system creates, like if you give power to people in a capitalist system, it's just not gonna end well. Like most of the time, it's just not gonna end well. So instead of having this language of, yeah, more representation, more women in power, blah, 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 let's remove gender from the equation and just talk about values, like feminist values, sure. You know, care, for example. Like, it's important to explain that women are socialized to care for others. You know, like Simone de Beauvoir, like the famous feminist scholar, she said that one, well, I always struggle to just translate that in English, one is not born a woman but becomes one. And basically what she meant is that you are not born with those values of like caring or blah, blah, blah. It's like you become a woman, and the path to womanhood is a path to submission, basically. So that's it's really important to understand that, because when you hear women, especially liberal feminists, glorifying women, glorifying their education and the fact that they are so quiet and disciplined, whereas boys are like so noisy, you know, what they glorify is an education to submission. So, for example, we have this historian in France. She's called, I talked about her in my video on liberal feminism. She's called Lucille Pétavin. And she wrote an entire book about, oh, if only men could be educated like girls. And it's like a lot of people will subscribe to it because like, oh, yeah, you want a nice, quiet people, blah, blah, blah. But basically, you're just promoting submission. Like you just want boys to be just as submitted as women. And I feel like, you know, like it's important to explain that and to be clear on that, because then, and I guess that's the next step of white feminism or bourgeois feminism, whatever you want to call it. It's like once the boys do not want to submit, once they refuse to behave like the girls, you know, and you see it sometimes in France. We saw it last year with when a young Arab man called Nael, a teenager, was killed by a police officer. And then you had a lot of protests happening. Wow, the coverage on the media, especially, that's where you saw like white feminism. Like you saw it so, so clearly, because they were like, oh, look at the boys. Like for any reason, they'll go out in the street and create chaos, you see? So it's like, if the boys don't behave, if they refuse to behave, what do we do then? Well, we're going to have to use force. We're going to have to use the police. We're going to have to put them in jail. And that this is the limit of white feminism. White feminism, it's just profoundly pro-carceral when you really think about it, because it's just based on those essences. It doesn't see class, it doesn't see race, it doesn't see all the reasons why those boys went and protested after the death of Nael, you see? So for me, like, this is really the core issue with white feminism. But I'm not the first one to say this. You know, black feminists, intersectional feminists, they've been saying this for like decades. It's just we're only starting to listen to them. So if you take someone like Angela Davis, for example, she's talked about the carceral system. She talked about the way black boys are being discriminated against, and how the sort of bourgeois feminism is kind of playing into that. It's not solving that issue, but actually reinforcing it. So we need to pay more attention to that, you see, and look at all the intersections, look at class, look at race, to really understand, like, when there is anger coming from men, when there is violence coming from men or women, is it really just because they are men? Is it just like some sort of, you know, like a surge of like testosterone boost, all of a sudden it's like they want to go out and destroy a bunch of things? Of course, like there is a little bit of like, you know, like socialization there, but deep down, like there are other things as well, race, class, etc. The white feminist doesn't want to see that. She just looks at, you know, gender or education. Education is often a term that comes back.
Yeah, I think Hillary Clinton is probably the prime example of that in the United States. How it is, it becomes meaningless after a point. It's just empty gesturing, much like, you know, what was done with the Black Lives Matter movement. It was completely co-opted. It was eviscerated by the neoliberal ruling class and turned into, you know, these empty symbols that are supposed to signify progress and inclusion, but really it's just another handout to the ruling class to maintain the status quo, to keep those in power by placating the people they have beneath them. I think that applies to neoliberal feminism as well.
So yeah, okay. So we talk a lot about new mechanisms the so-called far right uses to further distance people from class consciousness, as we've talked with the previous two points here on the show. One particular development is the almost total focus they've given women, in particular women's liberation, as the cause behind so much alienation that men are feeling. Obviously, I don't think this needs a call out for our particular audience, but let's just make sure everyone knows that it's just classic reactionary bullshit of pushing attention away from the system to another outgroup to blame. This has started a long conversation about masculinity in general, something you've tackled quite eloquently in your work, if I may say so myself. But what we don't talk about enough, if at all, because, well, we're not women in this show in particular, so our experiences limit us, and we admit to this, is how the right tries to engage women to join their causes. In your latest work, you talk about birth control, for example, and how that's a whole topic. But could you please tell us more, introduce us to, for the lack of better terminology, the pitch that the right gives to women?
Yeah, I mean, like, birth control is, for me, such a good example to explain that sort of phenomenon, how the right... Because when you look at there was a study recently published showing that it went kind of viral, showing that more and more men vote conservative and more women vote liberal. Mm-hmm. So that means that the conservatives have to, you know, find new solutions to get more liberal women on board. You see it on YouTube, more and more young sort of Gen Z women take on, like, the... I'm thinking about Brett Cooper. I'm thinking about, I can't remember her name, for PragerU. So they're trying to put, like, young female faces at the forefront of their media. So that's one thing of how, like, they try to get women to engage with conservative ideas. And birth control, oh, gosh. Because there's more and more awareness around, like, the complication, like, the side effects or that comes with birth control, and I'm definitely one of those people who kind of suffered a little bit, or at least were misguided in terms of, like, birth control, etc. They capitalize on that to then bring the conservatism. So it's like, hey, you've been mistreated by, I don't know, the big pharma. You've been taken advantage of. You've been not even listened to by your doctors, etc. Well, we can give you a path towards, you know, we will listen to you. Like, we'll provide a voice for you. Which is normally something that the left does, you know, it's like we talk for the voiceless. But it's like then it gets reappropriated by conservatives regarding birth control. And then it's like, come. And I mean, it's a pretty effective trap, to be honest. And it starts very low-key, like with some sort of divine femininity language of like reconnecting, balancing your hormones, going on this journey of optimizing your blah, 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 you know, like very holistic, spiritual girlies type of language.
Like Ben Shapiro's sister type of vibe, right? Am I getting it right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I would say that her, like she's a good example of like someone who bridges who's quite open about her conservative.
Yeah.
But like, if you really look at the more, because to be honest, like for me, what's happening with birth control at the moment and like the, it's pretty much the same thing as the manosphere. It's like the female version of the manosphere in the sense that it starts with lifestyle. It's like young men would be drawn to the Andrew Tate or blah, 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 because they wanted advice on like how to get rich or how to look fit or blah, blah, blah. And then they get fed with the misogyny, with the far right ideology. Well, it's kind of the same thing with birth control. You see, it's like, hey, this sort of lifestyle, divine femininity, balance your hormone, reconnect with your feminine self, or blah, 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 get rid of all the chemicals and just nature and blah, blah. And then you get fed with the conservatism, the, hey, just get rid altogether of birth control, and actually birth control is bad, and actually abortion is bad, and blah, blah, blah. And then it's just a vicious, the pipeline is there.
It's as pushing, hey, look at all the men sexualizing you. This is bad. And then the answer they give to that is you need to be more traditional and more well kept together and dress more, quote unquote, modestly. Politely, modestly, yes, et cetera, et cetera. Listen more to your husband. Look at this data where women who are more submissive are more happy. Ha ha. We are making great points here, et cetera, et cetera. It's an immediate loop jump in that I've definitely, like, thank you very much for explaining, because I was wondering, does the same thing happen with these women that present themselves as kind of eloquent speakers for quote unquote an alternative type of woman's rights in the same way that guys like Andrew Tate, as you mentioned, and hundreds of other LARPers of masculinity kind of use as a fishing hook and afterwards turn it into far more devious and far more, well, let's face it, like hardcore reactionary mentality. But, you know, the right has always kind of struggled in getting people who are feeling genuine like material oppression, the way obviously women are, ethnic minorities are, et cetera, on their side, because there's little to pitch to them that has been quote unquote taken away from them, because that's usually the main argument. But now as we see more and more and more connecting to the previous conversations we've had, women in the case of this conversation, entering higher stratas of society, there is something to pitch to them that they're going to lose, or they've lost if you let the, you know, evil libs or communists come and take all your shit. And as that develops, as the system kind of brings, like, starts ignoring identity more and more, because again it needs a fucking workforce, we will see it being able to bring more and more people that you would never ever think, just because of their reality in which they live. People you would have never seen before, not only being pitched to, but completely embracing this sort of rhetoric and ideological perspective. That's why, again, as Alice mentioned many times, it's very important for us to always remember intersectionality, always remember the root causes behind these problems, and always remember that these guys at the end of the day aren't really pitching us solutions, they're just pitching us an alternative perspective to systematic core analysis of where our most of our alienation originally comes from.
At the same time, it's like, when I started to learn more and more about the ways, like, the sort of identity discourse was appropriated by the elite to just avoid having to do anything with the actual problem and just, you know, solving it with more representation or blah, blah, blah. It's like I was more and more prone to be like, no, it's all about class, it's class, it's class, it's materialism. And so I started adopting this very, like, materialist way of looking at things, where it's like, no, it has to go back to class in some aspect. Even if we do intersectionality, like, we have to emphasize class. But then I was confronted with this thought of, like, even if when you've done the work of explaining, like, the structures of explaining how capitalism works and, like, how it's important to stand with the working class, that, you know, the working class is not just people working in factories. It's like, it's also you when you pay, like, 60% of your income goes into rent. Like, that means that you're fully dependent on your job. Like, if you lose your job tomorrow, you're pretty fucked. So that's, you know, like, getting that sort of awareness. But at the same time, like, I remember having a discussion with someone and explaining those things, and they told me, yeah, but at the same time, and they were talking about it in the context of trans identity, at the same time, you kind of need also that more identity sort of discourse, like, what does it mean, for example, to live as a trans person, or what does it mean to live as a man in the 21st century, what does it mean to live as a woman in the 21st century? So it's like balancing the sort of class structure analysis, but also providing some answers as to how do you live in that system, how do you become yourself. And it doesn't have to be self-helpy or whatever, like, you know, there are ways to talk, like philosophy, for example, like is a good way to better understand the self in a political way, etc. But, like, I feel like as much as I love the materialist analysis and I feel like we need to have more of that, we also need to make sure that we still give answers to people, like, on how to live as this or that, whatever the identity is. If that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense.
Absolutely, 1,000%. I mean, the same way we're now criticizing, hey, you know, all these liberal feminists, this is what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. If you're like, what was that old term that very much so can apply to a lot of people? Class exceptionalists, I think that was the terminology, where, like, oh my God, class is absolutely everything.
Class reductionists.
Class reductionists, thank you. Then you just like, for example, if I live in a random country, Germany, and I'm a class reductionist only talking about the working class in Germany, I see absolutely no connection between Germany and its minorities, Germany and global imperialism, Germany and all of the different social imbalances that exist in the country because, to an extent, of this class dichotomy, but also because of predefined historical stereotypes which might come from the class dichotomy, but after the class dichotomy is explained, they will not just magically go away. I mean, we had states throughout history that, you know, called themselves socialist, and let's even accept that, you know, they were socialist experiments, etc., etc., that did insane fucking racist shit, like fucking absolutely insane stuff, because they did not, take up the, again, to nail it into our beautiful audience's heads, the more intersectional perspective of not anything exists in a bubble. And that's kind of half the point of, you know, Marxist thought, that absolutely everything is interconnected. And that interconnection influences who you yourself become, how you view the world, and how you view that the world should change and improve, etc., etc. So absolutely, both the class reductionists or those who only 100% want to concentrate on identity are missing the wider point. And that is, at the end of the day, that it's, you know, pretty complicated, but that does not mean that it is difficult.
And you know what, like, what frustrates me a lot is that terms like feminism, or I guess now it would be more like intersectionality, have been so like exploited by capitalism in the form of like completely depoliticized way, that when you use those terms now, there's a bit of a, you feel like you need to do a lot of disclaimers, or you need to like give a lot of context, because it triggers people. Like, even on the left, it really triggers people. And so it frustrates me a lot, because when you look at the people who came up with those concepts, or the people who, you know, like made them grow, or in academic circles, etc., it's like they had really good intentions. Like, they didn't want capitalism to appropriate the work they've done. But that's ultimately what happened. Unfortunately, like, I don't know, like, sometimes I wonder, like, should we invent a new concept? Like, should we come up? But it's always going to be the same thing, right? It's like, you invent a concept, it gets appropriated. And that's why capitalism is like so, so powerful, because it has this capacity to absorb like all the criticism and turn them into something like marketable that you can buy with sparkles and everything. You don't want to end up like in a very pessimistic state where it's like, oh fuck, like capitalism will always win in the end, because we can do things. And I feel like we need to reclaim those terms, we need to reclaim those words, and do the proper educational work as well by being critical also of like the liberal appropriation of those terms. But yeah, no, I just wanted to say that, because sometimes like I find myself just like spiraling into, we're fucked. Yeah. But no, we're not fucked.
Not at all. Absolute optimism is not only necessary, but more realistic than the...
Radical optimism, like Dua Lipa said, yeah.
Yes.
But without turning into like... toxic positivity or whatever. Now we're just throwing terms around. But no, like, I wanted to comment, like, I couldn't agree more. To like, every single time, even during this episode as we're recording, when I call it like liberal feminism or white feminism, I'm like literally taking a piss on the world feminism, because it has nothing to do with that. Like, it would be like just too confusing for us to just call it capitalism, because that's what it is. It's just capitalism. But again, the nature of language and its historic connotation leads us to basically not really be able to create words on the spot to explain something else, because et cetera. But
it's the nature of language, you know. Yeah. It is the base problem is capitalism, but it's got all these little tendrils that work its way into concepts that already exist and co-opt them, and then suddenly the language means something different, and then everybody's talking past each other. But the base problem, the core issue of capitalism, remains the same. It's like a hydra. You have to find a way to kill all of the tendrils at the same time as killing the hydra itself. It's a challenging thing. Language, I think, language itself is a big barrier to progress, because if we don't all know what we're talking about, then how are we ever going to move forward?
But then you start talking about language, and then it gets like insanely complicated. Yeah. There's like fucking 700 fucking other terms that you're interjecting. Yeah. And, like, your brain is melting, and you need to fucking explain this to somebody else, and it's your computer screens are just exploding in front of you. But
alas.
It's like, I remember once I went to, there was a seminar during my studies, a feminist seminar, and it was like kind of such a caricature, but you know, they had to introduce themselves, and because there are so many different branches of feminism and like this and this and that, basically the introduction lasted for like, 10 minutes, because they had to add all the adjectives to make sure that we very clearly understand from which sort of academic background or like school of thought, that's what I wanted to say, school of thought they are coming from and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, do we really have to do that like every single time we introduce ourselves? I don't know.
All very well said. I think, let's see, we're getting kind of deep into the podcast. Let's move a little bit away from the feminism stuff for now. And you've got
the capitalism stuff, JT. We just established the capitalism stuff, okay?
Excuse me, yes, the language thing is failing me yet again. but you've got this great video on education under capitalism where you talk about this current panic that, oh no, Gen Z or Gen Alpha or whatever, they're all stupid and they don't respect anything. And there's this tendency to blame the kids for behavior that's seen as counterproductive, you know, by capitalist standards. And obviously that's been a problem for as long as people have been around, right? Across many generations, the older people always think, you know, the kids are dumber or less capable or doing things wrong or whatever. But the kids themselves are only part of the equation. Could you talk a little bit about the role of education, how it was seen in the past versus what it's become under capitalist regimes?
Yeah, I mean, like, first of all, like, I think it's important also to talk about the framing, because, like, it's always like, oh, yeah, boomers criticize young Gen Z for being lazy and blah, blah. And it's like, again, always adopting this very, like, generational way of looking at things, when in fact, like, most of the time, the boomers who complain about Gen Z are right-wing boomers, like, let's be honest. So, you know, I mean, some left-wing boomers do complain about kids as well, but we keep hope for them, but we can change them. But anyway, so yeah, it's like this sort of old right-wing discourse of like, oh yeah, young people, they don't have enough experience, they can't do this, they can't do that, and blah, blah, blah. Completely failing to, just completely depoliticizing the issue, really. Like, it's interesting to look at the topic of education, because like most of my audience on YouTube comes from the US, but I'm French. And in France, the education system is, I'm going to say better, but like, of course I complain about it a lot, but it's not as bad. Let's say it's not as bad as the US.
Yeah, there you go.
But you still see like how it's evolving, like with neoliberalism and like how teachers' pay are going down and how the expectations around teachers are getting stronger and stronger. And it's like, I guess like for me, the biggest issue is like the competition coming from private institutions and how they create a new standard for education while simultaneously public schools are being defunded, so you have a greater and greater gap. I don't know. Like, I remember when I was in Ireland, like every single school I would pass by had some sort of like, yeah, we create a very like corporate language, as if like they were already like forging the kid to be like a CEO or whatnot. Like,
human capital.
You know, like all those very, capitalist terms of like project and empowerment and I don't know, like I can't think of any others.
Trajectory.
You see like all those very like corporate sounding terms and how I've read a lot also about like how the sort of management mentality has penetrated you know, the education system, how even parents, when they organize, you know, like in schools, like they have their own demands, and those demands are like, it's just, yeah. But again, like, we're gonna sound so stereotypical saying this, but it's capitalism is the problem again. It's clear to me, and I'm actually writing another video on education at the moment. It's probably going to be out when the podcast is out on academia and why academia sucks. And because you know, there's this growing discourse of, no, you don't need a degree, you don't need to go to college, you can make more money outside of college. And you've seen that a lot with the Manosphere as well, where it's like, no, like, come to my hustler university instead of going to normal university. So it's just, there really is something going on. There are a lot of frustrations with education, with the privatization of education, etc. And some people decide to leave, which, you know, like, college is not the the ultimate, like, it's okay not to go to college, but it's just like this, if people, it's not the question of like not wanting to go to college, it's like not being able to go to college. And that's yeah. where it gets problematic, because I mean, I won't give away too much of what is in my video, but yeah, it's just it always comes down to neoliberalism and how academia is basically turning into a huge corporation. And it's the same thing with primary, secondary education. Like,
it's a big mess. It's like, I have a young daughter, and so I think about this a lot, where it's like, okay, so we want her to get, you know, a good education. We want her to be safe. Safe is a big thing in the United States right now, with all the school shootings and stuff.
I'm sorry, I had to go there. Yeah. I had to.
No, you're right. That's what we're thinking. Like, that's the number one reason we're considering moving out of the States, is so that we could go somewhere where there aren't school shootings. But, you know,
at least we don't have that problem, eh? Like, Jesus.
Yeah. Enjoy, you guys. Yeah. Be appreciative of that. But, like, if we, you know, if we send Evie to public school, you know, she might get shot and the schools are defunded and all this stuff. But it's like, if we go the private school route, that's got its own problems. Like, it's all very corporate. Mm-hmm. You're paying for this privilege. Then you've got the people who are like, well, just do homeschooling and stuff. But if you go the homeschooling route, and then it's like, you got a lot of weird religious tendrils reaching their way in. Also, you have then the social aspect of it. Maybe the kid's not going to be as well socialized. And then when you get to the university level, it's like, well, you've got the right who think their indoctrination centers, and then you've got with the protests that we've seen now, you've got the New York cops or whatever cracking down on students and faculty and arresting all of them for protesting. It's like, wow. So where do we begin to untangle this mess? Like, if from the beginning, if from the earliest ages of the education system, you have students, you know, marched into school earlier than they should be, sat in chairs for 8 hours a day. They're beholden entirely to the authority of the teacher and the bell, crafted into docile little worker bees. They are carving off anything that would make school more engaging, you know, whether that's art classes or literature or anything like that. They are shaving off as much fat as they can. It's a big problem, and I don't know what the correct answer is besides, you know, tear the whole thing down and start from scratch. But it's interesting to watch how all of these problems intersect, create different solutions, which themselves have their own problems, especially with like the Hustler University stuff, and creating these alternative systems of education where, you know, the merit is questionable and the actual the stuff of quality is prohibitively expensive. I don't know what the answer is.
That's why, like, when I hear about what's going on in the US, there's a sort of, at least we're not there in France, but we're definitely going in that direction. So, for example, a few years ago, Macron, our president, completely changed the way students apply to go to university. So public universities, most universities in France are public, and actually you get the best, I mean, it depends. But like, imagine you want to do law. It's actually better to go to a public university than a private university, because it's...
That's great.
Yeah. So all of that to say that there was this platform for students to apply to then go to public universities. And then Macron completely changed the system, or at least like refused to create more space for students in those universities, to the point where it became really, really selective. And so what's happening now is that parents who can afford to get their kids into private schools and avoid the sort of long anxiety of like, am I going to get in the school that I want or am I not, blah, blah, blah. Well, parents who can afford that will do it. So in the past few years, there's a rise of like the sort of business schools like emerging out of nowhere. And it's kind of scary because like it started as business school and now it's like business and health and business and environment. Mm. And it's like, whoa, like so... They are really taking on like every single subject and just adding the word business to it and just like making it more and more private. And this is really, really developing in France. And the ads for these schools, it's just, but again, like it's this very corporate language of like, and like, yeah, we're going to get you a job and we're going to get you the best internships. And when I compare my experience of university, so going to a public university, to some people I know from high school who went to, you know, private universities or business schools or private engineering schools, etc., it's true that, gosh, the amount of opportunities that they got, like the good internships, they didn't even have to look for them. Like the school had them all prepared for them. Whereas for me, it's like there was no incentive to, you know, like do internships or to, it was just like, ugh. And obviously when you see that gap And then it's your time to, you know, like think about with your children, like where you want to put them, what you want to do. And you have that experience. It's like, obviously you want the best for your kids. So you want to put them in, give them the best education possible. But it's like, you just, by doing that, you are partaking in that system and you're kind of creating those inequalities as well. So it's kind of, I know like on an individual level, like it's such a tricky situation, isn't it? But I guess like it's just how to exist in a capitalist society when you're like progressive left wing or whatever. It's like you're constantly betraying yourself, basically.
Yeah. It's tough when it's the only game in town. Yeah, what do you do?
It's hilarious that like the Hustler University types I mean, there are like 700 institutions like this that hyper-concentrate on, hey, universities suck nowadays because they're not a guarantee that you're going to make a lot of money. So come to ours because you're going to actually make a lot of money. Which literally like 100% misses the point that universities are getting worse because they are turning more and more into institutions that exclusively concentrate on making more money. I mean, the original school, et cetera, was created for more factory workers, blah, blah, blah. We all know this. But even higher education that through academia was sometimes managed to squeeze through a few departments that actually want to create people that don't hyper-obsess about money, just systematically get defunded. Because as Alice said previously, institutions which guarantee you the best internships, the best starting positions, the best starting salaries, the highest level of employment. What happens in a free market? More and more people go there because they want to feed themselves. More and more people go there, so those universities make more money. Those universities make more money. They can pay higher salaries to their professors. So the good professors start migrating to those universities, no matter how much they might disagree with it. Again, they need to put food on their own table and their family's tables. And then those universities eventually, as time progresses, which I believe to an extent is exactly what happened in the US, and if we continue with this applying the free market logic to education, it is eventually going to come to pretty much every single corner of the world, because if the religion that we all follow, if the definition of success that we all follow is profit making, then any institution that cannot elevate how much profit you can be making is going to be deemed unnecessary, or in the best of cases, kind of be thrown at the sides as kind of like a side gig thing. Like, you know, the ancient meme that for us is ancient, but I think it's probably like 30 years old probably, is, haha, art students, what did you expect? You fucking studied art, now you're broke. Yeah. This is going to expand to everything. This is going to expand to absolutely everything except studying business and something directly like business for this particular industry, because again, absolutely every industry from health to aesthetics to the fucking metal birds we throw in the sky is privatized. And metal birds, I'm gonna sound insane, I'm talking about planes, chat.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got it.
Which nationalize airlines, but okay, different conversation. Is going to be just turned into a profit-making mechanism, and therefore all education which cannot turn you into a member of the profit-making mechanism is basically useless, is what I'm saying. And this is a problem that is both systematic, but also a problem that we've kind of elevated by ourselves, by taking education in general, in my opinion, just for granted. You know, this is just a thing we have in society. It's always going to remain the same, et cetera, et cetera. This innate thinking that connects to kind of almost everything we've talked about today, that things exist in bubbles outside of the direction that the system pushes it in. They'll make your places of study into profit making mechanisms. They'll privatize your fucking water. They'll privatize your fucking air at some point. I'm sure I don't know if we're gonna have kids. JT does, but I can absolutely see JT your daughter buying bottled clean air at the age of 50.
We said we were gonna be optimistic.
In an alternate universe where exactly,
but there's plenty of air to buy. We didn't run out. There's the optimism.
But just to conclude on that, I guess. But going back to the Hustler University and all of that, it's like the more you privatize education, the more you make it inaccessible. I mean, it's we're always targeting a specific class of people. You know, it's like working class people, mm-hmm. lower middle class people. And so what do these people do? You know, like we all want upward mobility. Like we want to live better than our parents, hopefully. Yeah. Especially when you're working class, or especially when you're lower middle class, where you've seen poverty firsthand. So if you, they can't go to university, if the business, schools are too expensive, then of course they're going to be seduced by the sort of hustler university discourse where it's like, hey, you can make a lot of money super fast. And it's like, this is how you do it. Of course, like those people like the Andrew Tate, or I remember in one of my videos I talked about the betting platforms as well, how they specifically target working class, lower middle class young men. Yeah. Because these are the people who they want upward mobility, but they don't have access to any opportunity to actually get that sort of upward mobility. So obviously they're going to be interested in those things. They are perfect price, the perfect targets for that sort of discourse.
The market provides. There you go. The market will provide for them as well.
Yeah, especially if they're taught that they're losers if they don't make a lot of money. When they're presented with ways to make that money, then of course they're going to bite at the chance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a vicious cycle. Well, there you go. That's I think we've solved it. Capitalism is the root cause of all of these issues. So if you want to fix education and healthcare and all the other things we've talked about, I guess we got to do the thing that you're not supposed to say on corporate platforms. So moving towards wrapping up, let's I want to talk about France a little bit, just in general, and the state of the French left while we've got you on the show. So how is the French left dealing with all of these intersecting issues? You've got, you know, the massive unpopularity of neoliberalism. You know, here in the States, we see all the protests in France. We're like, wow, I wish we could protest like them. But then also, if you look beneath the surface, you're like, yeah, but those, you know, they're spontaneous protests. They don't actually have any real political aims besides making things difficult. What is the state of the left in France? And what does the future look like for the left?
Yeah, I guess there are several things happening at the same time. There's the person who would be identified as like the French left-wing leader, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He created a very strong youth-based movement in 2017, if I'm not mistaken. It was kind of in the same sort of time as Bernie Sanders was doing the same thing, Jeremy Corbyn was doing the same thing, like very youth-led movement and really politicizing young people with left-wing ideas. So that happened like a long time ago. And since then, it's been pretty chaotic, not gonna lie. We have had this sort of reversal of, in the past, like the far right was seen as like, you know, really bad and like you shouldn't interact with them and they are the devil. And now it's kind of reversed where it's like the far right is becoming more and more institutionalized. The government is taking inspiration from their policies quite openly. And on the other side, like the left is being turn into the devil, especially since like with what's happening in Palestine. Gosh, it's absolutely insane. Like they put a Palestinian Franco-Palestinian woman on the list for the European elections, and since then, like, oh, the police even came to her place to just it's just for I don't know the term in English, but basically like when you call for like terrorism, when you like when you like you promote terrorism or whatever, or you say something that encourages terrorism, which is
inciting
not true.
Terrorism, yeah. Uh-huh.
It's insane. Yeah. It's insane. Like, but anyway, I won't go too much into that. But yeah, it doesn't look pretty lately. And again, there's this sort of problem that I guess the left in multiple industrialized societies have is that you have a disconnect between the sort of urban, more identity politics left, and the more like working class, sometimes a bit reactionary left. And so it at the moment, they're trying to find a way to bridge the two. There are two leaders. Mélenchon would be more the representation of, you know, the sort of urban left. And then we have Ruffin, who's a sort of a rising star, the second favorite political personality among French people. So that's a good thing. And he's kind of rising as well. He has this more like working class identity, someone to look up to, really. Ruffin, Ruffin, if some of you wants to check him out. So yeah, that's what's happening. I want to remain optimistic. And I think we can do something if we really choose the grassroots option, because the media is really not collaborating. So we're gonna have to find different ways to get to people, to change, you know, to it's always this thing of like reconquering the working class, but But yeah, I guess that's the state at the moment. The French protests last year were definitely interesting and sort of rekindled. Mm. Was it last year? Yeah, rekindled some sort of like class consciousness.
But especially yeah, with the pension reforms, that was very impressive.
Yeah.
It was very impressive. Yeah. Very organized with a specific goal in mind, et cetera, et cetera. And if you remember back then, like, they just fucking ignored it. Like, the government, I mean. Yeah. Even though it was so successful and so massive. Why do you think that happened? Like, Macron has enough, like, base or... I mean, I know that now I'm throwing a very, like, complicated and long question towards the end of the show. But I was very surprised. Simple. I was like, this has to...
Oh, no, it's very simple. He just doesn't care about what the people want. So, like, he's done...
Nice.
He's consistently dismissed what people wanted, what the parliament wanted. No debates, nothing. He used all the secret tools in the constitution to pass that law without any form of democracy. That's why people were really pissed. Then that's why the protests were like so intense, because like he was basically telling French people fuck you, telling the parliament fuck you. So it's like, obviously if you treat us this way, obviously we're gonna go out in the streets and protest. But you know, one thing I liked about the protest is that you saw the more like trade union type of left, let's say, like the, you know, the, and you saw the urban left. And that was a beautiful moment where we were all together in the streets, all protesting against Macron, all protesting against capitalism, against the retirement reform, etc. Some younger people had more of a sort of long-term vision of like changing society, whereas trade unionists had more of a, no, we don't want that specific reform. But still, like, we were out there, we had the same goal in mind, and that was a really, really beautiful moment, honestly, yeah.
Mm. And as many times throughout history, you guys were an inspiration to the rest of the world.
Thank you.
God bless the French and their ability to protest and do cool stuff with tractors.
This is the first time that on the program we're not just shit-talking the French hardcore, just so you know, so that we don't sound like
hypocrites,
okay?
All right, we'll wrap it up here. Alice, thank you again for coming on. It's been a blast. We always appreciate your insights. Once again, could you tell the audience where they can find your stuff, what you're working on, anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, you can find me on YouTube, obviously. I'll post every 2 weeks max. Instagram as well, Alice Capelle, I think. And I don't post that much on Instagram, but I mean, if you want the more personal stuff, let's say. Other than that, yeah, I guess that's pretty much it. And my book, Collapse Feminism, if you want to learn more about, what's the pitch again? conservative ideas, you know, managed to spread in online spheres, especially in lifestyle spheres, not necessarily just political spheres. So yeah, that's it for me.
Excellent. Fantastic. Thank you so much. With all that being said, we'd like to thank our wonderful patrons without whom we could not run this show. We appreciate you very much. Lots of kisses from the bottom of our dirty little commie hearts. This has been The Deprogram. I'm JT.
I'm Jugopnik.
And I'm Alice. And I'll close by saying, solidarité avec tous les camarades.